Wednesday, we had some questions. Yesterday, we had some answers. Today, some analysis of the economics of the Trump presidency, days 108 through 112. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. It is Friday, the 12th of May. Good as always to have you along, everybody. You know how sometimes there is so much going on, you don't know where to start? This has been, repeat after me, one of those weeks. So what we're going to do is take it nice and slow, chronologically-like. Lynette Lopez writes for Business Insider. Catherine Rempel is a columnist at The Washington Post. Hey, everybody.
Hey, Kai.
Hey, Kai.
Catherine, let me start with you. And I was going to add, my first question was going to be, how bogged down do you think the Trump economic agenda will be given the firing of James Comey on Tuesday night? But I guess I should ask you whether you think it's going to get bogged down at all.
It already has been bogged down.
Oh.
I mean, part of the key to getting tax cuts through was getting the Obamacare repeal through.
Mm-hmm.
And that turned out to be not as simple by any stretch of the imagination as either Trump or other Republicans seem to think it would be. And so we're basically running out of time. I mean, we already are still stuck in this Obamacare repeal stuff. And then remember that the rest of the year, we still have to get through funding the next fiscal year, debt ceiling. There's like a lot of other stuff that's crowding the agenda that will make it very difficult to get to tax cuts, assuming that that is what you mean when you say the Trump agenda.
Well, right. And there's that the other side, too, the trade side,
right,
which is the Trump administration has still not been able to confirm Lighthizer, the trade negotiator.
No, he just got confirmed yesterday.
Oh, he just got confirmed yesterday?
Yeah, yesterday afternoon.
Well, it's,
but here we are, day 112, right? And we're still working on this. You know?
Yeah. Well, it seems like the senators, especially from border states, are starting to be emboldened to speak out against Trump's NAFTA agenda, which is what, you know, John McCain has started doing, pushing back against the president. And I think Comey has hurt President Trump's kind of strength when it comes to being a bully in the Senate and making people scared of him. People are starting to feel like they can counter him.
Okay, so let's go then, though, Catherine, to I guess it was I've lost count. Was it Wednesday or Thursday? Yesterday, I guess, the interview in The Economist in which the president once again seemed economically uncertain, shall we say, whether it's prime the pump, whether it's talking, as Lynette said, about trade, whether it's tax plan and deficits. There was not a complete command of the facts.
Not at all. I mean, almost to a ludicrous degree. Like, I think my favorite part of that interview was when he said something about how insurance is supposed to cost $15 a month for the rest of your life up until you get Medicare at age 70 or something like that. Anyway, there were just so many pieces of evidence of his confusion and lack of grasp of the facts and in apparent disregard for ever having to learn the facts.
Right.
That was particularly troubling, I think. You know, and he had his economic advisors in the room who did not exactly do much to try to correct him or nudge him onto
Gary
the right path.
Gary Cohn was the COO of Goldman Sachs. He's a titan of industry. And he sat there and he said nothing while Hope Hicks was answering questions.
She's a
20-something girl.
Nothing. It gets worse, right? Set aside Hope Hicks for a minute. Set aside Gary Cohn. The Secretary of the Treasury, Steven Mnuchin, also a veteran of Goldman Sachs, deeply experienced, as I said yesterday, in the global economy. He goes along with the president when the president repeats falsehoods about China manipulating its currency. So the question is, what advice is he getting? You know?
Yes. Yes. I think Mnuchin actually said something like, as soon as Trump got elected or as soon as he got into office, I forget how he phrased it, that, you know, they stopped. They reversed themselves when, in fact, China has actually been propping up its currency since, I think, 2014, which, you know, for listeners out there who might not know, was before Trump was elected.
It was very supervillain henchman-like, you know, very like, you know, yes, master. It was very strange. And there's so much that happened this week that you just feel like it was a whirlwind. I will appreciate a weekend, but I don't know if we're going to get one.
Well, if, you know, there's only two more working days till Monday. We're going to get to today. We're going to get to that letter that came out this morning from the president's attorneys. stating that he had had, with very few exceptions, no income generated from Russia for the past 10 years. Catherine, remind me what's interesting about the tax returns. It's not the income, it's the debt, and it's to whom you are obligated financially, right?
Well, it's both. I mean, there are reasons to think that he could be beholden to some Russian counterparty on both levels, right? I mean, like, he has actually gotten income from Russian sources. So, for example, there's a home in Palm Beach that he bought, I think, for $40 million or something. Yeah. And then turned around shortly thereafter and sold to a Russian titan for about twice as much. We don't know why, but maybe it was totally innocent. Maybe there's something shady that was being covered up. Maybe, you know, like, lots of people have suggested terrible things.
If only we could see these mythical tax returns instead of receive a letter from his lawyers. I mean, I saw that headline and I was like, I just don't care. Until we see these tax returns, it doesn't matter what these people say anymore. Just show them. That's it.
We got to go. Lynette Lopez at Business Insider and Catherine Rampell at The Washington Post. Thanks, you two.
Thanks.
All right. Bye-bye. On Wall Street today, sideways mostly, kind of all week, actually. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. All right, so we nibbled around trade a little bit. Catherine and Lynette and I did. The White House has followed its one-page tax reform outline with a two-page trade deal with China. There's a lot in the thing, everything from beef to financial services to energy, as Marketplace's Andy Euler is about to tell us. But it is wise to remember that at the same time, this agreement is but a drop in a very big trade bucket. Here's Andy.
China is trumpeting the deal as proof of its commitment to open markets and global free trade. The timing couldn't be better. This weekend, 30 international leaders will attend a summit in Beijing promoting One Belt, One Road, China's massive infrastructure scheme to boost trade between itself, the Middle East, and Europe. Both Presidents Xi Jinping and Trump have underscored how much cooperation the new deal took. Chad Bown is with the Peterson Institute for International Economics. He says now, at least, China and the U.S. are officially on the same page.
Unlike many of the things that come out of this administration where it's an idea or it's a talk and there's no formal paperwork associated with it, in this case, there is an actual document.
The agreement would open China, the world's fastest growing beef market, to U.S. cattle for the first time since 2003. China could also buy liquefied natural gas from the U.S. That's great news for both those industries. But in terms of the U.S.'s $347 billion trade deficit with China, he says it's peanuts.
If the Trump administration is going to focus on bilateral trade deficits as their metric of success with particular trading partners, these deliverables are incredibly small.
The deal is a step in the right direction, says Alan Sykes, a law professor at Stanford University. But he says,
this is just the tip of the iceberg when it comes to trade issues. This is just a first step.
But some American banks believe it could be a giant leap if China lets foreign financial companies like Visa and MasterCard in on its electronic payments market. I'm Andy Euler for Marketplace.
Attorney General Jeff Sessions is turning back the hands of time in the criminal justice system. He has ordered federal prosecutors to charge defendants with the most serious provable crimes that they can, crimes carrying the most severe penalties, including, in some cases, minimum sentences. It's a rollback of Obama-era rules that gave prosecutors discretion in charging nonviolent drug offenders and could lead to increases in the prison population in this country and thus profits for companies running private prisons. Marketplace's Nancy Marshall-Genzer has that one.
The number of federal prisoners in jails run by private companies has fallen over the past few years. Right now, about 11% of federal inmates are in private prisons. That's down from 15% in 2013. That trend could change now that Attorney General Sessions has ordered federal prosecutors to charge defendants with the most serious crimes they can.
It's certainly, a helpful directional trend for the prison operators.
That's Peter Cohn, an analyst at Heights Securities. This winter, Attorney General Sessions also reversed an Obama administration decision to stop sending federal prisoners to privately run jails. Cohn says there are now empty beds in some private prisons.
They have idle capacity in several facilities that, they're no doubt eager to start, you know, contracting with the federal government.
The private jails could see thousands of new federal prisoners because of the new Trump administration policies, says Carl Takei, a staff attorney at the ACLU's National Prison Project. But Takei doesn't think this is a good thing. He points to a report on private prisons from the Justice Department Inspector General late last year.
The Inspector General report found that the private prisons experienced 9 times more lockdowns, more violence, and they failed to provide adequate medical and security staffing.
I reached out to the two biggest private prison companies for comment. Neither would give me an interview. But in a statement, one of them, the GEO Group, says, quote, "We provide safe, secure, and humane environments." In Washington, I'm Nancy Marshall-Genzer for Marketplace.
You been looking to buy a house lately? Yeah, not so easy, huh? Here's one reason you might be having trouble. Since 2005, the number of single-family homes on the rental market, that is, not available to buy, has gone from 10.5 million to 17 million. That's according to the Urban Institute. And while a lot of those rentals are managed by individuals or small businesses, a growing number of them are owned and managed by corporate landlords, with shareholders and stock prices breathing down their necks, which could mean, as Marketplace's Kimberly Adams reports, some big changes as we become a nation of renters.
Sorry to do this, but I need to take you back to the peak of the housing crisis.
10.7 million households nationwide are underwater on their mortgages.
Here in Nevada, it is ground zero for the housing crisis in this country. Look at the valley behind.
Home prices here have dropped more than 61% from the peak in 2006.
At one point in Las Vegas, one of the hardest hit cities, one out of every 14 homes was in foreclosure. And investors, the only ones with cash, were snapping up those cheap homes as fast as they could.
Nice to meet you. Hi.
Hi, I'm
Ashley. Realtor Sean Marion remembers that time well. We talked during an open house for a 4-bedroom, Mediterranean-ish style home in the Las Vegas suburbs. It has a pool with 2 waterfalls. Marion told me back during the crisis, he got a lot of business from a Canadian investor.
I sold him 52 homes in a 12-month time frame, and we wrote offers on about 400 homes, and these were all cash offers.
Plenty of American companies stepped in, too, including big players like American Homes for Rent, Colony, and Invitation Homes. They bought tens of thousands of distressed properties in cities like Atlanta, Phoenix, and Las Vegas and converted them to rentals. Jade Romani is a managing director at the financial services firm KBW, which works closely with these companies.
I do feel that the companies purchasing put a floor on home prices.
Romani says even though the homes accounted for only about 1% of the market, or about 200,000 homes nationwide, the sales helped end the free fall in prices.
These companies entered in and had the capital to invest directly in cash. Then they also put in on average around $20,000 of capital improvements.
Like much of the country, the Vegas market is rebounding. Prices are up almost 13% in the last year alone, according to the Greater Las Vegas Association of Realtors. But the slow recovery changed things, says John Restrepo of RCG Economics in Las Vegas.
A number of institutional investors came in with the anticipation that in a few years, they could then resell those homes as the housing market came back. It's not worked out quite like they anticipated, primarily because the housing recovery took a lot longer than anyone anticipated.
But it seems to have worked out pretty well, at least for these corporate landlords. Over the past week, several of the big players have rolled out solid quarterly earnings. But growth, says Romani of KBW, will depend on creating concentrated areas of housing where rents are rising and you can bring down maintenance costs.
The real way is to be a scaled player, which means to own north of 500 homes in a given market so that you can efficiently service the homes.
With the housing supply so tight and prices rising, it's not so easy to snap up cheap homes anymore. So some of these companies plan to expand by building new ones and putting them up for rent. In Las Vegas, I'm Kimberly Adams for Marketplace.
coming up.
This is just the first step in the process. Everybody seems to be waiting right now to see what the president's going to do.
Step number one, map it. Step number two, track it. But first, let's do the numbers. Dow Industrial's off 22 points today, about a tenth percent, 20,896. The NASDAQ gained 5 points, less than a tenth percent, 6,121. The S&P 500 down 3 points, about a tenth percent there as well, 23,090. For the 5 days gone by, the Dow off 0.5%. The NASDAQ up, though, 0.3%. S&P 500 went the other way, 0.3%. Kind of sideways all week, as I said. Apple is giving Corning $200 million, its first investment from Apple's new Advanced Manufacturing Fund. Corning, you might remember, gets the credit for that tough what's known as Gorilla Glass on the very first iPhone. Apple shined up 1.3%. Today, Corning up about 0.9%. Bond prices rose. Yield on the 10-year T-note down to 2.32%. You're listening to Marketplace. I'm Kai Rizdahl.
And I'm Molly Wood.
We host a podcast called Make Me Smart.
And we want to know what you want to know
about business, technology, and culture.
Write to us at makemesmart@marketplace.org.
And check us out wherever you get your podcasts.
Behind every successful business is a story. And some of them might surprise you. Like how Chobani's first yogurt factory was discovered on a piece of junk mail. Or how the founder of the multi-million dollar cosmetics brand Drunk Elephant was told by everyone, including her own mother, that the name sounded like a dive bar. On the podcast How I Built This, host Guy Raz talks to founders behind the world's biggest companies to learn how they built them. In each episode, you'll hear entrepreneurs share moments of doubt, failure, and how they were able to overcome setbacks on their way to the top. How I Built This is like a masterclass in innovation and creativity. A how-to guide for navigating life's challenges from the people who've done it all. Follow How I Built This wherever you get your podcasts. Listen early and ad-free right now on Wondery Plus. For more business content like this, listen on Wondery, the destination for business podcasts. With shows like How I Built This, Business Wars, and many more, Wondery means business.
This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Rizdahl. Retail and its discontents. We have told you about stores and entire chains closing. Shares like today getting hammered as investors grow more pessimistic about brick-and-mortar retail in an e-commerce world. There is, however, one silver lining. Business from store-branded credit cards is actually up. Likely, though, too little too late. Marketplace's Adam Allington has that one.
In some ways, store-branded credit cards were the original retail innovators, back before Costco started making money from subscriptions or Amazon started charging for Prime.
The problem is, increasingly, this is the only place they're making any money, and they're also shrinking.
Mark Cohen is director of retail studies at Columbia Business School. He points out that department store credit cards are popular because of the steep discounts they offer, which further cut into the store's bottom line.
And so it begs the issue of what kind of a future do these legacy retailers have?
According to analysis from Morgan Stanley, 39% of Macy's 2016 profits came from credit cards. For Kohl's, it was 35%. But Ann Brower, a retail expert with McMillan Doolittle, says store cards are valuable not just for profits, but also the customer loyalty.
Your credit card customers are better customers overall. They're bigger spenders. They tend to be more profitable, and they tend to utilize more of your channels.
Matt Sargent, a retail analyst with Magid, points out that Amazon has its own customer loyalty perks. So, are credit cards enough to keep brick-and-mortar retailers above water?
By themselves alone, they are definitely not enough to keep the ship afloat. That it is a profitable side of an overall downward trend.
Sargent points out that store-branded cards also come with higher interest rates. So, while they are doing bang-up business now, if the economy slows down, that business could turn south fast. I'm Adam Allington for Marketplace.
In airline news today, Spirit, the budget carrier, and its pilots union have agreed to indefinitely extend a judge's order for pilots not to engage in any work stoppages while contract talks are going on. Perhaps you saw the brawl that broke out earlier this week at Spirit's hub down in South Florida amidst a raft of airline cancellations, which the company blamed on some pilots' refusal to fly, a charge we should say that the union discounts. But the economic reality of it, as Marketplace's Annie Baxter explains, is that low costs do have consequences.
Spirit has had a bad reputation for flight delays and consumer complaints. But this weekend's melee notwithstanding, it had been doing better lately.
They've actually managed the operation far better in this past year. They clearly need to do even more of that.
Airline consultant Robert Mann says Spirit redesigned its aircraft schedule to make service more reliable. He thinks the recent troubles could have to do with the airline relying on pilots to volunteer to staff extra flights.
When the volunteerism doesn't manifest, airlines can find themselves short of pilots.
The pilots deny there was any kind of deliberate work stoppage. But business travel expert Joe Brancatelli wouldn't be surprised if pilots wanted to express displeasure over their salaries. He says Spirit has to have lower labor costs for workers in order to offer ultra-low fares. Regardless of their cause, Brancatelli doesn't think Spirit cares enough about flight disruptions.
They work on the theory that you'll have to put up with any kind of bad service we have because, after all, you're not paying a lot, and you understand that.
That is, until customers get enraged, as they did Monday night in Florida. But does it matter? Spirit is profitable, and other carriers are increasingly following its lead, charging for every last amenity and cutting legroom, which Brancatelli acknowledges.
Last week, American Airlines announced their newest planes will have the same seat legroom as Spirit Airlines. This is an industry racing to the bottom.
Brancatelli says the only way to get airlines to change is for consumers not to fly them. I'm Annie Baxter for Marketplace.
All right, how about something totally different about public policy and this president? One of the ways Donald Trump likes to sell himself as both candidate and now as president is as a builder.
So did you ever think you'd see a president who knows how much concrete and rebar you can lay down in a single day? Believe me, I know.
That's President obviously talking to the North American Building Trades Union earlier this year, and it gets us to the bridges, roads, and dams that will be, one assumes, part of the infrastructure program the president has promised. Except we don't know what's going to get built. Tom Scheck is on the investigative team at APM Reports. They've been looking into a list of hundreds of infrastructure project suggestions for the White House. Hey, Tom.
Hey, Kai.
So election day comes and goes. The president, as I just played that clip from, campaigned on this infrastructure program. You learned that his advisors and folks around the country are putting together a list. You try to get it. What happened?
Well, we went to a lot of the states and said, hey, can you give us your lists? Obviously, these are public projects dealing with taxpayer money. Some of the governors were more than willing to do that. Other governors were not so much willing. In all, we have more than 500 projects and mapped them. Now, there are differences here, Kai, with these projects. Some rely completely on tax dollars. Think of it like, you know, public money going to a bridge. That's how it gets built. There's also this thing called public-private financing where there's public money and private money. And then there's direct private investment. And that's one of the things the Trump administration is really looking at.
Yeah, talk to me a minute about public-private, because the president has said more than once it's a trillion-dollar project. It's actually $150 billion in government tax credits, and then the president and the administration are hoping on $1 trillion of private investment. But how does private investment change what gets built?
What we see is that this private money is used for investment, but there's a big, big problem with that. Private investors are going to move their money where the market is, for example, the first thing. Second thing that they're going to want to do is get a return on the investment. Think of a toll for a bridge or a road. And if you talk to Greg DiLoretto with the American Society of Civil Engineers, he says that, you know, there's a big difference. There's going to have to be hard cash here.
Financing infrastructure is not the funding of infrastructure. Financing is access to capital to do that funding. But at the end of the day, you have to have cold, hard cash to build these projects that need building.
And a lot of that whole cold, hard cash that he mentioned is going to go to places where there's a lot of people or a lot of money. And one of the concerns with privatization of these things is that rural America and low-income populations aren't going to get the projects that they may need because the money's not going to go there.
Talk to me then about, it's a list of 500-ish. What'd you see on the list that made you go, huh, that's interesting?
Well, first off, it's amazing how old some of this stuff is. The rail tunnels between New Jersey and New York City are a century old, and to just build two new rail tunnels there, it's going to cost upwards of $25 billion. So there's a lot of money at stake.
If somebody goes to the map at marketplace.org and does not see a project or a thing that is on their wish list, what does that mean? Does that mean it's just not happening?
Well, they may want to get their member of Congress on the speed dial quick because this is just the first step in the process. Everybody seems to be waiting right now to see what the president's going to do. And then there's going to be 535 different priorities from the members of the House and Senate that are going to come into this. And that's really when the food fight and the excitement's going to start, because they're going to have a big say too. And if the Trump administration wants to get this done, they may have to cut some deals to put some projects in and then maybe remove some other projects. So that's where things are going to get really interesting.
Tom Scheck, he is with APM Reports, our investigative team. We're working with him to track the White House infrastructure plan as it develops. You actually can check our map, see if your favorite bridge or dam or what have you is on it. You can find it at marketplace.org. Tom, thanks a lot.
Thank you.
Final note on the way out today in which Wall Street makes even less sense. I saw this on Bloomberg this morning. There are now more stock indexes, or indices if you prefer, than there are stocks. The big ones, you know, the rest are all custom designed, you might say, built by brokerages and trading houses to include stocks with specific characteristics. Could be low volatility or nice dividends. And then, of course, trades based on those indexes or indices are then sold by the companies that created. And to quote occasional friend of the program, Josh Brown, on Twitter this morning, there are about five indexes that are real. Rest of them are just licensing opportunities. Did I mention it's Friday? We got to go. The Dow off 22 points today, about a tenth percent. NASDAQ up 5 points, less than a tenth percent. S&P 500 down 0.3%. Our theme music was composed by BJ Lederman. Marketplace is produced by Nancy Fargali. Sitar Nieves is the executive producer. Deborah Clark is the senior vice president and general manager. I'm Kai Rizdal. We will be back on Monday. Have yourselves a great weekend, everybody. All right? This is APM.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.